Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today we're launching into an exploration of something really fascinating and, well, often overlooked, I think. The relationship between the Kurdish people and the Jewish communities who lived right there in Kurdistan. We're talking over 2,000 years of history, specifically focusing on the time before 1948, before the State of Israel was established.
Yeah, it's a history with incredibly deep roots. We've gathered quite a range of sources, historical analyses, firsthand accounts from travelers back in the day, research on the, you know, the social fabric, the culture of Kurdish Jews.
And our aim today, for you listening, is really to unpack the key parts of this shared story.
Exactly. Looking at where it all began, those ancient origins, how life unfolded under different empires, Ottoman, Persian, the unique culture that blossomed there.
And also the interactions, right?
Yeah.
How did Jewish communities get along with their neighbors, Kurdish Muslims, Christians, other groups?
That's a crucial part of it, the dynamics between everyone.
So for you, our listener, think of this as a way to get a handle on a complex relationship without getting buried in detail. We want to offer a clear, balanced view based on the sources we have.
Trying to reveal some of the, well, surprising facts and insights about this really diverse region.
Okay, let's get started then. Where do we begin? The sources point way back, don't they? Over 2,500 years.
That's right. The Jewish presence in Kurdistan is seriously ancient. Tradition strongly links the earliest communities to the exile of the Northern Kingdom of Israel.
By the Assyrians?
Yes, the Assyrian Empire, back in the 8th century BCE. The Bible, the Second Kings, actually mentions exiles being settled in places near Kurdistan.
No.
And then you've got the Babylonian exile a couple of centuries later, 6th century BCE. That brought a large Jewish population to Mesopotamia, right next door, which, you know, undoubtedly influenced the area.
So this wasn't just a brief encounter. This was long-term settlement, people living side by side for millennia. That must have led to some unique cultural mixing.
Absolutely. That sheer length of time, sharing the same geography, almost certainly fostered kinds of cultural exchange and adaptation you wouldn't see in, say, more recent diasporas.
And there were earlier hints, too. Something linguistic.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. The Aramaic translator Omkalos, when translating the Bible, rendered the phrase mountains of Ararat as mountains of Kardu. Now, Kardu is widely seen as an early reference to Kurdistan. It suggests a very, very early awareness, a connection between Jewish tradition and this specific region.
Wow. And then there's the Kingdom of Edibani. That seems like a really significant moment.
Oh, definitely pivotal. We're talking about the first century CE, right in the heart of Kurdistan. The royal family of Edibani, Queen Helena, and King Manobaz, or Izatis, as he's sometimes known, they converted to Judaism.
The actual rulers.
The rulers themselves. And this likely had a ripple effect. It's plausible that many of their subjects might have followed suit or at least become more integrated into the existing local Jewish communities. It could have really solidified and expanded the Jewish presence there.
Is there any backing for that?
Well, the Talmud, the central text of Rabbinic Judaism, actually acknowledges converts coming from Kardu. So it seems to support this idea of integration happening.
And it wasn't just stories or texts, you said. There's physical evidence.
Yes, archaeological finds. Near Urmia, researchers have found items with possible Jewish iconography that could date all the way back to the 8th century BCE.
So actual objects.
Tangible proof, yeah. It helps ground these ancient connections in something material.
Okay, let's jump forward quite a bit to the medieval period. Things sound pretty established by then. We have accounts from Jewish travelers, right?
Oh, we do, and they're invaluable. Benjamin of Tudela and Patasha of Regensburg, both traveling in the 12th century, their accounts give us these incredible firsthand glimpses.
What did they find?
They recorded something like 100 Jewish settlements spread across Kurdistan. 100. That tells you it wasn't a small, isolated group. It was a substantial population, widely dispersed with deep roots.
Benjamin of Tudela mentioned Ahmadiyya specifically, didn't he? With a huge community.
He did. He estimated around 25,000 Jews just in Ahmadiyya. Now, numbers from that era can be tricky, but it still suggests a very large, significant community for the time.
25,000. Speaking Aramaic.
Yeah, he noted they spoke Aramaic, calling it the language of the Targum, which points to this incredible linguistic continuity. And he mentioned they had notable scholars among them, too. It paints a picture of a vibrant internal life.
And Mosul wasn't far away. How did that big city factor in?
Ozul was definitely important, a major trade and spiritual center near Kurdistan. It had its own well-established, prosperous Jewish communities. They even enjoyed a degree of autonomy.
A safe haven, almost.
In some ways, yes. It apparently became a refuge for Jews fleeing violence elsewhere, like during the Crusades or later the Mongol invasions. So its stability likely offered some support and connection for the communities deeper within Kurdistan's mountains.
But it wasn't always stable or peaceful within Kurdistan itself, was it?
Mm.
This brings us to David Alroy.
Ah, yes, David Alroy. A really dramatic episode from the 12th century.
He declared himself the Messiah.
He did. It was a turbulent time, you know.
Yeah.
The Crusades were ongoing. The Seljuk Sultanate was maybe showing some cracks. It created an atmosphere where, well, messianic hopes could really take root.
And Alroy himself, he was from Ahmadiyya.
Yes, from that big community Benjamin of Tudela mentioned. He was reportedly very learned, new Jewish law, Muslim literature, and people even believed he had, well, magical skills. His goal was ambitious. Liberate the Jews, lead them back to Jerusalem, recapture the city.
Wow, that's bold. It reflects more than just religious feeling, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It shows an engagement with the political realities, the power struggles of the time, alongside that deep religious yearning for redemption.
And he actually had a plan. Something about seizing a fortress.
Yes, the citadel in Ahmadiyya. The story goes his followers were meant to gather there, pretending to study with him, but hiding weapons.
Did it work?
Well, word got out. News reached the Sultan. What happened next is a bit tangled, history mixed with legend. There are stories of his capture, a miraculous escape, his defiance against the Sultan.
So he really challenged the authorities.
He did. Apparently, established Jewish leaders pleaded with him to stop, fearing reprisals against the whole community. But he refused.
And how did it end?
He was eventually assassinated. Some accounts say it was his own father-in-law, possibly pressured by the authorities or acting out of fear.
But his influence didn't just disappear.
No, for some, the belief persisted. There were followers known as Menahemites, particularly in Azerbaijan, who continued to believe in him for some time. The whole Alroy episode, it really highlights the pressures, the hopes, and the sometimes radical responses within the community during that era.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Road Japation.
Ah, wonderful timing. Right on cue.
You know, Hannah always makes the best chai. What do we got today? Ooh, cardamom infused. Perfect. The aroma is just fantastic.
It smells delightful. Just what we need. A little pause to refresh before we carry on.
Absolutely. Okay. Chai in hand. Let's shift gears. Life under the big empires. Ottoman and Persian. Kurdistan gets split between them. That must have changed things significantly.
Oh, definitely. From the 16th century onwards, you have this division. Most of Kurdistan falls under the Sunni Ottomans, while parts come under the Shia Persian empires, Safavids, Qajars, and so on.
So Jewish communities in different parts of Kurdistan are now living under different rules.
Exactly. Different legal systems, different social pressures. It likely meant their experiences started to diverge, and maybe contact across those new imperial borders became harder.
Both empires had this category for non-Muslims, right? The dhimmi status.
Yes, the dhimmi framework. Under traditional Islamic law, Jews and Christians were considered people of the book. This generally granted them protection for their lives, property, right to practice their religion, but... And it's a big but.
There were strings attached.
Major strings. They had to acknowledge the supremacy of Islam, pay a special tax called the jizya, and adhere to a whole range of social and legal restrictions.
Restrictions like what specifically? What did it mean day to day?
Well, things like limits on building new houses of worship or even making prominent repairs to existing ones. Often they couldn't bear arms. Their testimony might not hold equal weight against the Muslims in court. Sometimes they had to wear distinctive clothing. It varied.
And you mentioned Shia Persia had an extra layer.
Right. In Shia Islam, particularly in Persia, the concept of najast, ritual impurity, was applied to non-Muslims. This created additional social barriers, limiting physical contact, affecting where people could live or work, reinforcing that sense of separation.
Sounds like a system that offered a kind of security, but very much a second-class status. And you said it varied.
Greatly. Enforcement wasn't uniform. It depended heavily on the specific ruler at the time, the particular period in history. Some eras were more tolerant than others, and importantly, the location. Local governors or officials could interpret things very differently.
The Ottomans also had the millet system. How did that work for Jews in Ottoman Kurdistan?
The millet system was the Ottoman way of organizing their non-Muslim subjects. Each recognized religious group, including the Jews, was granted a degree of internal autonomy.
Self-government, kind of.
In a way, yeah. They could manage their own internal affairs, religious law, marriage, divorce, inheritance, education, communal institutions under their own religious leader. For the Jews, this was the Hakam Bashi, the chief rabbi, who represented the community to the Ottoman state.
Did that give them real power, or was it more administrative?
It certainly allowed them to maintain their distinct identity and handle their own community matters according to their traditions. But it's crucial to remember this was all within the larger framework of Ottoman rule. They were still dhimmi, still subordinate to the Sultan and Islamic law overall. It reinforced segregation as much as it granted autonomy.
So in Ottoman Kurdistan specifically, Jews were under this millet system. But you also mentioned the local Kurdish agas, the chieftains.
Exactly. And this is key for understanding the reality on the ground, especially in the more mountainous, remote areas where Ottoman central control was weaker. The day-to-day lives of many Kurdish Jews were often more directly shaped by their relationship with the local Kurdish aga. They relied on these powerful tribal leaders for protection and security.
An aga patronage system.
Precisely. It operated almost in parallel with the formal millet structure. Jews would offer loyalty, maybe services, gifts, payments, in return for the aga's protection. These agas could wield immense local power, sometimes more immediate than distant imperial decrees.
Despite all these layers of authority and potential difficulties, Jewish intellectual life still managed to thrive. You mentioned prominent rabbinical families.
Yes, it's quite remarkable. Families like the Barzani, Mizrahi, Duga, Hariri, they produce significant rabbinic scholarship over generations. This likely stemmed from that deep-rooted Jewish emphasis on learning, maybe some space afforded by the millet system, and just sheer dedication to preserving their heritage.
And didn't you mention a female scholar?
Yes, Asenath Barzani. A truly exceptional figure from the 17th century, based in Ahmadiyya. She was a renowned Torah scholar, sometimes even called a Tanaite, a title usually reserved for sages of the Mishnaic period, a poet. And she actually led the yeshiva, the religious academy, there after her husband died. Really quite extraordinary.
Wow. And economically. Yeah. They weren't just scholars, right? They were involved in trade.
Oh, yes. Very much so. Diverse economic activities. Some Jews from Kurdistan migrated into other parts of the Ottoman Empire, into Anatolia for trade. Later on, the 19th century Ottoman reforms, the Tanzimat, which aimed to modernize and centralize the empire. Well, they had complex effects.
How so?
They might have altered the traditional balances of power, maybe shifted relationships with Kurdish rulers, opened some new economic paths, but also created instability. And the formation of the Hamidi cavalry, these were Ottoman-sponsored Kurdish tribal units, definitely created a volatile situation, especially impacting Armenian and Assyrian Christians, which raises questions about security for all minorities then.
Okay, let's switch over to the Persian side, under the Qajars. You mentioned the Shia context and Najast creating more barriers.
Yes, that concept of ritual impurity generally led to stricter social segregation than in many Sunni Ottoman areas. Plus, the Qajar state itself, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries, was often quite weak and decentralized.
Meaning
that effective protection often depended less on formal laws and more on the attitude of the local governor or powerful figures. Life could swing between periods of relative calm and periods of persecution, even instances of forced conversions, though those were perhaps less common in the Kurdish areas compared to some other parts of Persia, like the infamous Al-Adad incident in Mashhad. Jews typically lived in separate quarters, the mahalla, with restrictions on occupations, clothing, even the height of their houses sometimes.
But things did start to shift later on. European influence.
Correct. By the later 19th and early 20th centuries, European powers were more involved, and international Jewish organizations like the Alliance Israelite Universelle, the AIU, started lobbying the Qajar government for better treatment. They also established modern schools in some areas.
And the Persian Constitutional Revolution.
That was a big moment, 1906 to 1911. It theoretically granted legal equality to recognized religious minorities, including Jews. They got representation in the new parliament, and the jizya tax was formally abolished, but
attitudes didn't change overnight.
Exactly. Deep-seated societal prejudices, often rooted in that concept of Najast and religious difference, persisted long after the laws changed.
So let's zoom in on life within Kurdistan itself, before 1948, beyond the empires. How were the communities structured internally?
Well, early on, sources mention leaders called Nesium, who seemed to hold significant authority. Later, it seems the local hakam, the rabbi, became the key figure in most communities, especially smaller ones.
Doing everything.
Pretty much. Serving as the religious leader, cantor, ritual slaughterer, teacher for the children, judge for minor disputes. A real pillar of the community. For very complex legal questions, though, they often looked to the more established rabbinate in Baghdad, showing that connection across the region.
And the aga patronage system we talked about, that was crucial in rural areas.
Absolutely central to the social structure in many villages. Jews would align themselves with a powerful Kurdish chieftain for protection.
A necessary relationship, it sounds like.
Often, yes, but it was a relationship with inherent risks. It could range from genuine mutual respect and protection
to something much worse.
Yes, unfortunately. It could involve heavy financial demands, exploitation, forced business partnerships where the aga took most profits, even in some reported cases, abduction and forced conversion of women, or outright violence. Conditions for some rural Jews under certain agas have even been described as resembling a form of servitude, and recourse was limited because of their subordinate dhimmi status.
How do they cope with that?
Jewish leaders became adept at navigating these complex power structures, using diplomacy, building relationships, trying to mitigate the risks within the system that existed.
And their language, you mentioned Judeo-Aramaic earlier, that persistence is remarkable.
It really is. They held on to these distinct dialects, sometimes called Lishna Yahudiya, Lashon HaTargum, Lashon HaGalut, Jabali for centuries. There were regional variations like Nashti Dan near Urmia or Lishani Deni in Zako.
A living link to their ancient past.
Exactly. While also absorbing words from their neighbors, Kurdish, Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Hebrew, showing that ongoing interaction. Storytelling was huge, especially among merchants traveling between villages, sharing news and tales in guest houses to one came. And linguists like Yonah Sabar have done vital work documenting this heritage before it faded.
Did they share stories with their Kurdish neighbors too?
It seems so. Shared folklore, proverbs suggesting a degree of cultural overlap and exchange at the grassroots level.
Music too, you said. A bridge between cultures.
Definitely. Their musical traditions were this amazing blend. You had Hebrew liturgical chanting mixed with the styles of Kurdish folk music, the epics, the ballads, the dance tunes played in Kurmanji. Jewish musicians, Dengbej, were known exponents of this shared style, using instruments like the zurna and dahola or daf that you'd hear at both Jewish and Kurdish celebrations.
And specific customs, pilgrimages, festivals.
Very important. There was deep reverence for the tombs believed to belong to biblical prophets. Nahum in Alquash, Jonah near Nineveh, Daniel in Kirkuk, maybe Esther and Mordechai in Hamadan, just outside Kurdistan proper. Annual pilgrimages to these sites, like Nahum's tomb after the festival of Shavuot, were major events.
And the Seirain festival.
Ah, Seirain. This was a unique celebration held in the days after Passover. People would go out into nature, camp, feast, play music, dance. It had a real celebratory communal feel. And interestingly, some scholars see links or parallels between Seirain and the Kurdish New Year festival, Newroz, or similar spring festivals called Seiran by local Christians. It hints at shared seasonal rhythms and maybe some cultural borrowing over time.
Let's talk education. Traditionally, it was religious.
Yes, the traditional maktab or cheder focused primarily on teaching boys Hebrew literacy for prayer and reading sacred texts. General literacy outside the rabbinical class was often quite low.
Then the Alliance Israelite Universelle, the AIU, arrived. Big change.
Huge change. Starting in the late 19th, early 20th century, the AIU established modern secular schools in several Kurdish towns, including in Persia like Hamadan, Sanandaj, Kamansha. They aimed to provide a Western-style education, often with an emphasis on French language and culture.
Part of a civilizing mission.
That was often part of their stated agenda, yes. These schools definitely increased literacy rates, offered some vocational training, exposed students to European ideas, but they could also create a cultural gap between the Western-educated elite and the rest of the community. Interestingly, by including Hebrew and Jewish history, some AIU schools inadvertently fostered early Zionist ideas among students.
Was there a pushback against this Western style?
To some extent. Later, another network, Or HaTorah, established schools with a much stronger emphasis on traditional religious Jewish education, partly as a response or alternative to the AIU's more secular approach.
And the economy. It sounds surprisingly diverse. Not just trade.
Very diverse, yes. And significantly, unlike many Jewish communities elsewhere in the diaspora, a good number of Kurdish Jews were involved in agriculture.
Farming.
Yes. Growing wheat, barley, rice, sesame, tobacco, tending orchards and vineyards, raising livestock. Some villages were predominantly Jewish farmers, like Sindor is often mentioned. In other places, they worked as tenant farmers for Kurdish agas. This direct connection to the land is quite distinctive.
What else did they do?
Skilled crafts were very important. Weavers, dyers, especially of indigo, goldsmiths, silversmiths, jewelers, carpenters, tanners, shoemakers. There was collaboration too, like making certain types of amulets, sepa, which involved both Jewish and non-Jewish artisans.
And trade, of course.
Absolutely central. Wholesalers, shopkeepers in the towns, but also itinerant peddlers, the Zazar, who traveled between remote villages, selling goods, and also acting as crucial carriers of news. Some were involved in larger regional networks, trading things like opium or silk, particularly on the Persian side.
Finance, too.
Yes, money lending, currency exchange were common roles. And then you had musicians, dancers, some positions, tailors, barbers, butchers, including ritual slaughterers, of course, and general unskilled laborers. A really wide range.
But life wasn't easy for most?
No, generally not. Economic conditions were often precarious. Poverty was widespread, made worse by the region's instability, conflicts, droughts, famines. While some merchants could become quite wealthy, they were always vulnerable to exploitation or sudden reversals of fortune. But their diverse roles definitely made them economically intertwined with the wider society.
Okay, let's dig into those interactions now. The Kurdish-Jewish relationship specifically. Sources seem to paint a mixed picture.
Extremely mixed, yes. You have many narratives, especially in oral histories collected later from those who emigrated, that emphasize relatively harmonious coexistence. People remember friendly Kurdish neighbors sharing daily life, mutual visits. There are stories of Kurds mourning when the Jews left, even looking after abandoned synagogues for a time.
What fostered that harmony?
Perhaps a shared minority status within larger empires, maybe certain cultural affinities. We talked about folklore, music. Living side by side for centuries inevitably builds connections.
But that's not the whole story.
No. That picture has to be qualified by the realities of the tribal structure and that aga patronage system. There was an inherent power imbalance. Jews were often dependent subjects, reliant on the aga's goodwill.
Which could be withdrawn.
Exactly. And that dependence opened the door to the darker side.
Yeah.
Exploitation, extortion, forced partnerships, the violence we mentioned earlier. Some accounts paint a picture of Jews living under quite oppressive conditions, almost like property of the aga in some rural areas. Recourse for justice was very limited under the Dhimmi rules.
So it's complex. Genuine friendship alongside potential exploitation.
Precisely. Both things seem to have been true, likely varying greatly depending on the specific time, place, and the individual aga involved. It wasn't uniformly one thing or the other.
What about relations with the other major minority group? They're Christians, like Assyrians and Armenians.
Also multifaceted. Kurdistan was home to large ancient Christian communities. There were points of connection, shared minority status under Muslim rule, linguistic links, as many Christians also spoke Neo-Aramaic dialects related to the Judeo-Aramaic ones. There are even traditions suggesting shared origins between some Assyrian tribes and the lost tribes of Israel, or claims of certain Assyrian families secretly maintaining Jewish practices from a Jewish ancestry.
But also tensions.
Definitely tensions, often related to interactions with the Kurdish majority or the actions of the Ottoman state. History records significant violence by some Kurdish tribes against Christian communities, intertribal feuds spilling over, or state-sponsored violence like the Hamidian massacres targeting Armenians and Assyrians in the late 19th century.
Did that violence affect Jews in the same way?
It's complex. Some commentators argue that historically certain Kurdish elements, especially powerful agas, could be hostile towards both Christians and Jews. Incidents of murder, plunder, abduction are cited against both groups. There were anti-Jewish attacks too, like in Zako in the 1890s. Yet in some places like Ahmadiyya and Zako, reports suggest closer, more cordial day-to-day relations between Jews and Christians, mutual home visits. One traveler in Zako even noted Jews were allowed to bear arms, which was unusual.
So status varied.
It seemed to. Another traveler noted that in Urmia, Christians seemed perhaps more subject to mistreatment than Jews at that particular moment. It's possible the Jewish reliance on aga patronage, while risky, sometimes offered a different kind of security or vulnerability compared to Christians who might be targeted more directly in large-scale anti-Christian violence orchestrated by the state or powerful tribes.
And shared religious sites, like Prophet Nahum's tomb.
Yes, Alqosh is a fascinating example. The tomb was deeply sacred to Jews, but located in a predominantly Assyrian Christian town. After the Jews left, the Christians became the guardians of the shrine. Reports vary. Some say they protected it faithfully. Others mention removal of relics over time. It shows the complexity of interactions even around shared sacred heritage. It was really a three-way relationship. Jews, Christians, and the dominant Kurdish tribes and authorities constantly shifting.
A real balancing act for everyone involved. Okay, let's move towards the end of this long era. The early 20th century brought huge changes, the seeds of change that disrupted everything.
Yes, the whole geopolitical landscape was shifting dramatically. The Ottoman Empire collapsed after World War I. New nation states, Turkey, Iraq, Syria were carved out, dividing the Kurdish homeland. This also meant the rise of competing nationalisms.
Turkish, Arab, Persian nationalism.
Exactly. Each created new challenges for minorities. Turkey pursued Turkification policies, suppressing Kurdish identity and language. Arab nationalism grew stronger in Iraq, especially from the 1930s onwards. Iran saw centralization under the Pahlavi dynasty and the promotion of Persian nationalism. Minorities like Kurds and Jews found themselves navigating these new, often assimilationist pressures.
And alongside this, Zionism started to gain traction.
Yes, modern political Zionism emerged as a force and began to influence Kurdish Jewish communities. It built upon that centuries-old religious longing for Zion. And there had always been small-scale migrations to Palestine, like scholars settling in Saft back in the 16th century.
How did it spread in Kurdistan?
Through contact with travelers, rabbis visiting from Palestine, emissaries. Organized Zionist activity started, particularly in Iraq, in the 1920s. Initially, it was tolerated, but later faced restrictions. Some sources mention that AIU schools, especially in Baghdad, where many Kurdish Jews also lived or passed through, had Hebrew literary societies that actually helped promote Zionist ideas.
Did people start leaving them?
Yes. Emigration to Palestine increased significantly in the 1920s and 30s. Thousands of Kurdish Jews made the journey during this period, well before the mass exodus after 1948. Figures like Moshe Barzani, who became known later in Israel, came from this background.
But things got much worse just before 1948, especially in Iraq.
Tragically, yes. The situation for Jews in Iraq, which included the territory where most Kurdish Jews lived by then, deteriorated sharply in the 1930s and 40s.
Why?
Several factors converged. Rising Arab nationalism, heavily influenced by the conflict in Palestine, became increasingly anti-Zionist and, by extension, often anti-Jewish. Nazi propaganda from Germany also found an audience and fueled anti-Semitism.
So Iraqi Jews were viewed with suspicion.
Increasingly so, yes. Despite their assertions of loyalty to Iraq, unofficial quotas started limiting their access to government jobs and higher education. Zionist activities were banned outright, and Jewish teachers who had come from Palestine were expelled.
And the Farhud.
The Farhud pogrom in Baghdad in June 1941 was a devastating turning point. It followed a brief pro-Nazi coup. Hundreds of Jews were killed, and there was widespread looting and destruction. It sent absolute shockwaves through the entire Iraqi Jewish community, including those in Kurdistan. It shattered any remaining sense of security.
So the years leading up to 48 were filled with fear?
Yes, growing fear and insecurity. Continued anti-Jewish sentiment, arrests, economic pressures, all these factors created the conditions that made the eventual mass emigration after Israel's establishment seem, for many, like the only possible path forward.
So as we wrap up this exploration, it's really clear, isn't it? The shared history of Kurds and Jews in Kurdistan wasn't simple. It was this incredibly complex tapestry.
Absolutely. Woven with threads of connection, going back millennia, real cultural exchange, times of relative stability where life could flourish, but also periods of real challenge, vulnerability, and inequality. The sheer length of time they lived together is remarkable in itself.
And that unique culture that emerged, the language, the music, the shared customs, and the resilience shown under all those different empires, Ottoman, Persian, local Agas, it gives us such valuable insights into the region's history.
A history that's far richer and more complex than often portrayed. Understanding these dynamics, the good and the bad, provides vital context for what came later.
Because those seeds of change in the early 20th century, the fall of empires, the rise of nationalism, Zionism, were so making worsening conditions, they did lead to a massive shift, a demographic transformation, really.
Completely altered the landscape of Kurdistan, removing a community that had been part of its fabric for over 2,000 years. Knowing this pre-1948 history is crucial if we want to understand the paths both Kurdish and Jewish people took afterwards in the modern era.
It really makes you think about how historical connections, even difficult ones, shape identities and futures.
So perhaps we can leave you, our listener, with this question to ponder. How does looking closely at this long, intricate history of coexistence with all its harmony, its friction, its interdependence, how does that inform the way we understand community relations today and maybe the possibilities for building more resilient, more equitable societies in the future?
something to definitely think about. We encourage you to explore the sources and stories around this fascinating history further.